This audio commentary is actually comprised of about 26 interviews done with members of the cast and crew of T2. My name is Van Ling. I'm the creative supervisor on the show, and I'm here to introduce the various speakers and to offer my own thoughts. Here's writer-director James Cameron to set the scene.
This special edition is really like selling the donut holes. It's part that was left over when you did the perfect release version of the movie. There are a lot of little scenes that are good. There's nothing wrong with them. It was the same cast, the same skills, the same writer, the same director, all of those things. But it turned out to be slightly less necessary than the pieces on either side of it in the final cut of the movie.
So there's certainly a group of people that are interested in seeing what those scenes were and what some of the extended canvas might have been coming from those same actors, those same characters.
Sound designer Gary Rydstrom.
The wind that's at the beginning of Terminator for the skull crush is partly just me into a microphone and then playing that on the synclavier mixed with a wind that was made in the mix room I was in by closing the door and the air conditioning was on. It would make this great wind under the crack of the door. We just recorded it right there. There's a very, very faint kid echoed in the distance in the beginning in the playground. You actually would hear him again in the nuclear nightmare. There's a lot of crunching and crushing needed for this film, so we crunched a lot of stuff. We found that nuts were really great. Pistachios were a very hard nut, and then if you cracked it, it made a great crack. We actually would crunch it by putting a big steel plate over the top of it, and it had a metallic as well as a nut crunch to it. And that's what we used for the robot foot crunching the skull. The one sound that we used as an element from the first film was the feature gun. It was a synthesized sound that was used. I added some real gun sounds to it, added some machine guns. But the basic element was stolen from the first film.
The Future War sequence was really complex because it involved so many different kinds of effect shots cut together, including miniature shots with full-scale explosions out on a location, with miniature projection process plates on a stage behind the actors, to some very large-scale composite shots where you see everything. These shots are all tied together with the lasers, which were done by Fantasy 2. Here's Gene Warren from Fantasy 2.
I think there's about 42 shots in the sequence that have laser beams in it to track them and locate them. It's really mathematics and physics to come up with the right perspective, particularly on moving shots where your perspective is changing frame to frame. So we actually had four different methods to go from the very close ones to the sort of mid-ground and then the deep mid-ground and then the far distance. And we're handled differently.
This tunnel actually existed out on the location. We managed to find this Future War location that was an absolute rubble-covered mess. It's actually right behind the steel mill where we shot all the steel mill scenes. It was used as a bombing range for the local Air Force base, so it was just filled with rubble. It was perfect for what we wanted. The collodion scar makeup that was designed by Stan Winston and applied by Jeff Dawn to actor Michael Edwards as old John Connor is the same kind of scar makeup used on Tom Berenger for Platoon. This upcoming explosion was done by pyrotechnician Joe Viscosol out in the El Mirage Desert for Forward Productions. Here's Dennis Skotak of Forward.
The explosion that Joe set off was an enormous one. There's like 250 feet of flame going up. And what was ultimately used in the film was the tightest version of it, where we were just on the wall of fire. And it's moving very, very slowly. And it's a very disturbing kind of image of this fire because it's an image you don't normally see in flame.
This explosion shot was actually meant for a scene that we never finished, in which Dyson, as he's dying, has this vision of flames. Here's composer Brad Fidel talking about main title music.
Usually the first thing I'll do is test out the main title. It's like a template. It's like saying, here is the vocabulary of the score. Here's what the percussion sounds like underneath. Here's the melody for when we need a melody. Here's the texture and the voices and the stringy type sounds. And here's sort of the whole thing. And then there might be cues later in the film where we can say, oh, let's use that signature percussion without the melody. Or let's use just the texture, just the ooh of the voices and take the rhythm out and the melody out. In T2, I chose to use more organic sources like a high violin played three octaves lower. Those sounds are the kinds of sounds that I like to use for the sustained textures. Percussion-wise, I'll do everything from sample a frying pan being struck with a hammer, which was actually one of the main sounds in Terminator. The metallic sound everybody thinks is an orchestral anvil or this or that. It's my cast iron frying pan with a mic right in the middle, and I'm going, bang!
This main title sequence in which we basically torched all the playground equipment that we used in the Nuclear Nightmare scenes was one of the last things we shot, and we actually shot it indoors on a stage. And Tommy Fisher, the practical effects man, was basically flamethrowing the entire area. This burning endo is actually a metal endo that we did put in between some flame bars because we needed the reflection of the flames off the chrome. The eye lights, though, were rotoed in optically by Industrial Light and Magic. This first scene where Terminator arrives actually called on the coordination of a number of different departments, from the Transportation Department to the Art Department to Fantasy 2, to add the lightning effects. Here's Gene Warren.
There was a lot of interactive light done on set with lights and flicker boxes set off camera, and this paper blows up and blows through so that you have to have hold-out mats for the paper to have the electrical energy jumping around behind the paper. The actual arrival shot with the energy ball, we cut into two parts, A and B, locked together through a whiteout frame. The optical on part A actually took 12 hours to composite, and side B took about the same.
The art department actually had to have a second truck that had this area hogged out of it in the corner. They also had to carve this divot out of the ground. Both of those areas were then painted with a front projection material that was highly reflective. They put a light next to the camera and dimmed it during the shot so they got the glow effect in camera. Here's casting director Mally Finn on finding extras for the biker bar.
It was actually Stephanie Austin who said, "I know where to find bikers." And so they set up a happy hour at a bar in Venice and invited all of these bikers to come to the happy hour. And they had free drinks for them. I just selected those that I thought might be good and had them come in, and we taped them.
Co-producer Stephanie Austin recalls shooting at the biker bar.
You never know what's going to happen on a film set. Outside there are film trucks and huge lights and real bikers who are working for us as extras. Hundreds of crew people, and we were shooting there all night. Arnold is dressed in boxer shorts, getting ready to do his scene. And we're all lit, we're inside, and a woman came in carrying her little handbag. She was kind of tousled. She looked like she'd been having a lot of fun. And wandered into this film set. There are lights everywhere, there are two cameras rolling, and there's Arnold Schwarzenegger standing there in these boxer shorts.
She looks at him, doesn't recognize him. She goes, "What's going on here?" Arnold looks at her and says, "It's male stripper night."
That was makeup artist Jeff Dawn, who also had to do the burning cigar makeup.
Steve Laporte and I came up with an idea of using a small aluminum plate with a little bit of Nomex fire cloth backing on it. And then Steve designed a small appliance that would fit right over that, very, very thin and flat, with a small divot right in the center. In that divot, we took a little bit of wax, mixed this with a little bit of red color, we covered up with some makeup, and all of the sizzling and popping and embers. It didn't burn Arnold a bit.
For this swinging cue shot, there's a steel pole behind Arnold's head so the biker could actually swing it hard. The big challenge in this scene was how to show Terminator being Terminator the way we remember him, yet not showing him killing anybody, because that would kind of take away from the point of the story. Music was really important for that as well. Composer Brad Fidel.
Part of what film scoring is, it's ultimately manipulating the audience. The chess game. In the first section of the film, it's not clear that he's a benevolent force, and the music needed to stay with that. I went right into his strength, his sheer power, which in itself is awesome and a little scary. Not necessarily saying he's bad, but then later, as he started to change, then the humanness comes into it.
Jim came up with the idea of using George Thorogood and the Destroyers' Bad to the Bone here as music that just sort of kind of comes out of nowhere, but it really kind of sets the tone for the character. There's a point where Jim basically said, you know, let's let the audience, you know, get a kick out of it. Let's really play up, you know, all the trademarks, the motorcycle and the leather jacket, and, you know, play up the fact that he's just this real badass, and set that up early so that everybody can just really say, okay, we know Terminator's back. The one thing that Jim did want to play a little bit with was the whole idea of the sunglasses and how they worked a little differently between this sequel and the original film.
Once the glasses were
gone, like in the second Terminator, it would actually work the reverse. In the first Terminator, you started with no glasses and you went to them.
Yeah.
So you got actually more kind of almost insect-like. And then in the second film, we used it in reverse, where you started with the glasses and then you lost them partway through the film. But even then, there's so much that you were doing with your eyes. And then later in the film, you soften a little bit and become a little more human. The thing that I think is really remarkable about the character is that he's really played through such small things, subtle details.
The arrival of the T-1000 was a scene we wanted to play a lot more low-key than Terminator's grand entrance in the previous scene. We were shooting down at the 6th Street Bridge in downtown Los Angeles, and we had to get rid of all of the existing debris to put in our own debris. So we brought in our own papers blowing around and sort of wrecked garbage, and we added our graffiti to the graffiti that was already there, and we added this piece of fence. Here are Jeff Dawn and Robert Patrick.
I remember when we were filming Robert Patrick arriving. We were downtown L.A. near the railroad tracks, and it's 4 in the morning. We're out there with all of our lights and our crew. Robert Patrick is standing out there naked. We've pushed back the majority of crew that's unnecessary to give some sense of privacy to him. So then there's only 40 people standing around looking at him naked there.
It was the first time I had to do a nude scene. But at that point, that was near the end of the movie. And I had really been in the mindset for so long that it really was a character for me. I mean, all your vanity and all your modesty kind of goes out the window. And the weird thing was, standing there in the freezing cold, to put my back towards the crew, I was exposing myself towards the train tracks.
All of a sudden, about 50 feet away, an Amtrak train comes rolling up. We have all these lights, so everybody, of course, is looking out the window. And here's Robert Patrick standing there, butt naked, waving to all these people pressed against the window with their mouths open. And we were cracking up.
Trains notwithstanding, there was also a different view of the T-1000 that was going to be in this scene.
The way it was written in the script, we were going to try and mislead the audience that he was just like Michael Biehn. He was a protector. And that would have changed things. And then why all of a sudden would he start acting like the T-1000?
This was an actual police computer that we got from a company that makes police computers, and we just kind of programmed in some bogus data. The Void House we shot out in an actual house up in Northridge. John's foster mother was played by Jeanette Goldstein, who everybody may remember as the tough colonial marine Vasquez from Cameron's film Aliens.
Won't even answer me anymore.
Honey, move.
Would you get off your butt and help me? Todd!
You notice this shot is actually done in one long single camera take, where I think Jimmy Muro was the Steadicam operator and just followed the action. It really kind of shows off that it was done on a real location where you can see all the rooms and you can't see off the set.
Not my mother, Todd.
Jim Cameron talks about researching the hospital.
I went to Atascadero State Hospital and, made some sort of visual notes on the security methods that they use in terms of their lockout ports, which they call Sally ports, with the full view glass doors and the control centers that allow the doors to open and close and all that. And then we went into an actual hospital, Lakeview Terrace Hospital, which was closed, I think, due to seismic damage, and put all that stuff in to make it look more like a state mental hospital.
Stephanie Austin.
Lakeview Medical Terrace is one of those locations that, as a filmmaker working here in L.A., I've used dozens of times. We've been searching and searching for a hospital, and we've taken Jim to see practically every venue that was available. We talked about Lakeview, and we thought, God, it's been seen so many times, I just don't imagine that Jim's going to like it. Finally, I said, look, can't hurt. Let's take him there. Let him see it, because it's a really terrific set. Luckily, Jim did love the set, and then proceeded to completely rebuild it so that it looked entirely different.
The mental hospital set and concept actually suited Linda Hamilton fine.
if I'm going to go back and play the same character, I want her to be crazy. And I saw her in a mental hospital. To come back and play the same woman, but the same woman who's taken a different direction so that you don't even have to play the same thing. And yet you get to have a closure in your life and in your performance.
Earl Bowen was the only other returning cast member from the original Terminator. He plays the slimy Dr. Silberman, psychologist. This woman here in the window is actually Arnold's assistant on the film, Anna Marum.
I don't like to see the patients disrupting their rooms like this. See that she takes authority, would you?
Sure, Dr. Silberman, I'll take care of it.
This scene was the first of the restored sequences in the Terminator 2 Special Edition. Jim Cameron talks a little bit about the scene.
Well, it's an interesting scene in and of itself. It sets up the antagonism with Dougie, which pays off later, obviously. The point there was we were trying to dig a very deep hole that she had to climb out of. And the deeper the hole, the more courageous she was for having gotten herself out of it. Because the point there is there was nobody to help her anywhere in the world. Nobody understood her, and nobody was willing to help her, and she had to do it. The consequences were great. Dougie beating her up and forcing her to take her medication is the trigger for the first dream sequence.
Sweet dreams.
One of the scenes that I enjoyed the most was at the Boyd house when I just get to be a cop and drop kind of the T-1000-isms.
You didn't really want him to be totally human. Because there was still, you know, the T-1000 lurking behind her. The day we did that scene, I think I was being even more intense. I mean, Jim actually had to tone me down. He said, you know, I don't want you to be an asshole. Because I was kind of like, you the legal guardian of John Connor? It's a wonderful disguise. I mean, who's going to question a police officer? Because think about it, he comes and goes, gets in and out, does whatever he wants to do. And it's all basically because he's wearing the badge. Hopefully the audience is a little spooked, you know, like, hey, you know, what's with that guy? He's not quite right. There's something weird about him.
You'll notice the dog is barking in the background in this scene. It's just the little touches that help foreshadow a little other elements of the Terminator mythos.
Mike, has that got something to do with this?
No. I wouldn't worry about him. Thanks for your cooperation.
Please insert your stolen card now.
John here is using an Atari Portfolio laptop computer to break into this fake ATM bank that bank teller that we built in front of a closed bank in the valley.
All right.
Like a lot of good scenes, scenes like this set up things both in terms of characters and in terms of plot information that become necessary. In this particular case, it's to, number one, set up that John's kind of a whiz with electronics and is good at breaking into things, and which pays off, of course, later when he breaks into the vault at Cyberdyne.
It's a wonderful disguise. I mean, who's going to question a police officer? Because think about it. He comes and goes, gets in and out, does whatever he wants to do, and it's all basically because he's wearing the badge. Hopefully the audience is a little spooked, you know, like, hey, you know, what's with that guy? He's not quite right. There's something weird about him.
You'll notice the dog is barking in the background in this scene. It's just the little touches that help foreshadow other elements of the Terminator mythos.
Mike, has that got something to do with this?
No. I wouldn't worry about him. Thanks for your cooperation.
Please insert your stolen card now.
John here is using an Atari Portfolio laptop computer to break into this fake ATM bank that bank teller that we built in front of a closed bank in the valley.
Pin number.
Like a lot of good scenes, scenes like this set up things both in terms of characters and in terms of plot information that become necessary. In this particular case, it's to, number one, set up that John's kind of a whiz with electronics and is good at breaking into things, and which pays off, of course, later when he breaks into the vault at Cyberdyne, but also to set up that he's a juvenile delinquent and that he's kind of cynical about the law and family, because that's a character arc that he has to go through. This Sarah Polaroid was a pain to find, because we had to go back to the Orion Pictures stills department, where it was buried somewhere in the middle of publicity photos, and to go find it in order to make dupes off of it to use as the prop on the show.
I tried to blow up the computer factory, but you got shot and arrested.
Oh, shit.
Total loser. Come on, let's go spend some money.
Jim Cameron, Michael Biehn, and Linda Hamilton talk about the next scene.
The first dream sequence was a kind of reiteration of the relationship with Reese, and really is of value to people who remembered the first film clearly and wanted to see a resonation of the first film in the second film a little bit more. Michael knew from the beginning that we were trying to work him in, and there was no, you know, organic way to put him into the story.
What we were trying to do was find all the major points in the first film and put them all together into that one little scene. Just kind of say, well, don't forget this is where this all came from. It was a little strange crawling back into that outfit, kind of a deja vu situation.
And there's a wonderful echo of the first film in this one. Michael had played a character who died in the first film, so he came back as the character in the first film because his character died and there's no growth. I had gone through, you know, this major history with myself and things that I've created and the things that the character has done, so I had a very different investment in the scene than I might have 7 years ago in our relationship. I didn't want to come back and play the same weak Sarah who he has to kind of hold up and get her motivated to go out there and win and do her job. Jim was kind of in between us dancing around, and it was an interesting day's work to sort of all try to find what we needed. Jim was like writing the scene. I would look at it and cry, throw it out. It was intense, but certainly it was a braver choice than I expected.
I thought it would remind people who had seen the first movie what the first movie was all about, or what I thought it was all about, which was a love story. It didn't surprise me that this didn't make the cut, because you've only got so much movie and it's not part of the storytelling.
The restream sets the story on more of a historical stage. The significance of what Sarah is trying to accomplish by getting out of the mental hospital is made clearer by that she has to protect the child who ultimately will determine the fate of the human race. But it also requires that you've seen the first film. And one of the things I always feel strongly about in a sequel is that it shouldn't require you to have seen the first film. It should be self-contained. Using that determinant, you know, we decided to take it out.
This dream led us out to the first original look at the Sarah nightmare. Stephanie Austin.
We were searching and searching for where we could do the nuclear nightmare. Jim wanted it to be overlooking the city. We had to see the skyline in the background. And we searched, and of course we naturally looked at Griffith Park. We looked at all these other things, and finally, our location manager, Richard Klotz, came up with Elysian Park, actually in a landfill. And we put in turf and set up swing sets and trees. There we were, basically in a garbage dump. And we had created this absolutely gorgeous, idyllic little park where children could play.
We were trying to do the first dream as just a first glimpse of the nuclear nightmare to come. That way it did not take away from the power of the second dream. It dovetailed very nicely, just showing the flash, to this video cut of Sarah saying it's like a giant strobe light, because it sort of continued the scene without having seen it. And it allowed the development of that nightmare to continue, so that we understood exactly what she was talking about by the time we actually saw the dream later on in the show. Scenes like this on the video monitor have to, of course, be shot before the scene in which they're being played back. So we would have to come in the weekend before the shooting of the scene in order to shoot this little video segment. And we had come in on a Saturday, and Jim was operating the camera himself because he wanted a kind of staccato, amateurish camera movement rather than the very smooth operating that the professional cameraman would have. Linda had to go through the whole range of emotions in this, just this little video segment, from total distress and defeat to rage. And it was quite an emotional ordeal for her to do the scene. And at the end of the final take, she kind of gave this quiet thumbs up because she knew she had gotten it perfectly.
Well, she's had to deal with all of the terrible...
The monitor have to, of course, be shot before the scene in which they're being played back. So we would have to come in the weekend before the shooting of the scene in order to shoot this little video segment. And we had come in on a Saturday, and Jim was operating the camera himself because he wanted a kind of staccato, amateurish camera movement rather than the very smooth operating that the professional cameraman would have. Linda had to go through the whole range of emotions in this, just this little video segment, from total distress and defeat to rage. And it was quite an emotional ordeal for her to do the scene. And at the end of the final take, she kind of gave this quiet thumbs up because she knew she had gotten it perfectly.
Well, she's had to deal with all of the terrible knowledge that she gained in that first part of the story. The knowledge that the human race would be virtually devastated by a nuclear war in the future. So we have a woman who's traveling through life with a terrible burden of knowing with great certainty that the world will end and exactly on what date. And it's driven her kind of to the point of madness, as it would anybody who really had to embrace and confront that knowledge. She has begun to think of it as a total inevitability. And very much that reflects, I think, the way we feel. There's just nothing I can do about it. If it happens, it happens.
She is trying to take charge of her own fate, but she's failed miserably so far. She hasn't stopped the future that she knows is coming from happening.
Much improved lately.
Me to have a goal, something to look forward to.
What is that?
Well, you said that if I showed improvement after 6 months, you would transfer me to the minimum security wing and I could have visitors. Well, it's been 6 months and I was looking forward to seeing my son.
I see. Let's go back to...
There's an interesting perspective shift in this shot in terms of the sound. We start with normal audio inside the room, and as we pull back through the surveillance window, the sound subtly shifts to that of the perspective from inside the surveillance window, where the sound is muffled from the other side of the one-way mirror, and Sarah's voice is coming in tinny over the television speakers and over the video recording.
I see. So you don't believe anymore that the company covered it up?
No. Why would they?
This object is the neural net processor prototype based on the Terminator's brain chip that you see on the monitor and on the desk there. You don't really get to see that much of it in the final film, in the final theatrical release of the film, but you do see a lot more of it in the special edition. This move through Cyberdyne was all in one take. Production designer Joe Nemec talks about the design of the Cyberdyne lab.
And we come through the clean room into this totally clean, machined, almost like you've just taken a block of aluminum and carved this space out, and that's where the chip and the hand obviously were kept.
The thing that attracted me most about the script in terms of Dyson was the fact that it was the first time I'd read, and hopefully we'll see, a sci-fi movie where the black character, one, was not killed within the first 10 minutes, and two, actually has some impact on the future. And in very much the same way at the Manhattan Project, Dyson is involved in sort of the scientific discovery of this neural net processor without allowing himself to think about the implications of such a design, certainly not allowing himself to think about the military applications of such a design. The same way that most of the men who were involved in the Manhattan Project did exactly the same thing. They just wouldn't allow themselves to think, oh, this is going to be for some destructive purpose, even though the outcome was fairly evident. And he just simply won't allow himself to deal with it until, of course, he's put into a position where he can't look at it in any other way.
Sarah is probably at her lowest in this scene, because not only is she trapped in a mental institution, she is under the care of Dr. Silberman, who is about as slimy a character as you can get. In the first film, he had said about Reese, "I could make a career out of this guy," in terms of studying his psychoses about the future. And it seems that in Terminator 2, he's gotten his wish, because he now has Sarah to study. This scene illustrates how you can use your camera and your sound to really follow the emotional beats of the scene. In this part where Sarah is urgently pleading with Silberman, the camera work is very intimate. It's close-ups, it's reverse angles, and it's somewhat traditional in that. But as she loses it, it switches to handheld and goes from being very quiet to very chaotic in the sounds, and everybody's shouting, and there's a lot of activity going on in the camera. You see it's very, very much moving all over the place, and it's handheld. This kind of use of the camera to follow the emotions of the scene is one of the things Jim Cameron does really well. Both Eddie and Arnold did a lot of their own riding in this film. Eddie took a lot of extensive training to learn to ride the dirt bike safely for the show and for these kind of shots. Sound designer Gary Rydstrom.
The Termovision was fun. The usual standard beeps and clicks, but we were also processing the real world through it so that it had a different sound.
All the cars you see on these shots with the actors in the streets are production vehicles. It's the way that you can ensure total control and safety.
That scene was cut a little short because when they say the Galleria and they say, "I'm new here, can you tell me how to get there?" and they start giggling, they start laughing. That was kind of funny.
The idea here was that Robert didn't know where the Galleria was because he was not a real police officer, and they were giggling at him, and he had this look of this kind of wet cat. But we cut it out because it kind of didn't seem to match the character, and it looked like people were having fun at 2000's expense. These mall scenes were shot at Santa Monica Place. And on the first day of shooting, we had set up the lighting conditions as being a sunny day. And on the second day, it was rainy and overcast. And the way we solved that problem, because it didn't match, was that Adam Greenberg, the cinematographer, had his lighting crew set up these huge lights on the roof, shining down through the skylights to create the artificial sunlight that would make the shots match. The video arcade in the scene was completely fabricated. It was an empty storefront that we had taken and added all of these real video games into. And Eddie Furlong had a field day there.
I wanted to go and play like the video games and the arcade there, because I've always loved video games. So every time Tia, my teacher, would give me a break, I'd always just run to the arcade and start playing video games. And it was really fun because you didn't even have to put quarters in. You can just flick that little switch thing and it'll just be like a billion quarters.
There's a transition for the T-1000 because he kind of goes from just a cop kind of scanning around looking for the kid. And then the guy said, "Yeah, he's over there." And then at that moment, the T-1000 kind of reads it. If I wanted like the eyelids kind of going up, it's like, aha, target.
The service corridor in this scene was actually realized through the use of both a real location and a set that duplicated it on a stage for all the firing of the weapons so that it wouldn't disrupt the real location. Hey, Jim likes to use slow motion to protract these scenes of realization. So you notice that all the scenes in this particular area are in slow motion, and he takes it up to a certain point and then all hell breaks loose. But it gives you ability to really study the movements and get a geography of where everybody is, because in real life everything would be happening at once and you wouldn't be able to see what was going on.
You're not really supposed to blink in real life when you shoot a gun. You're supposed to keep your eyes on your target, and that's how you see what you're shooting. So I really wanted to make sure in those tight close-ups that, you know, you just lock down and squeeze them, because the burst, and you know, you want to twitch, but you can't do that. I remember Jim having to remind me a couple times, don't exert anything on your face, especially in the fight scenes. You, as a human, you want to strain and all that kind of stuff. And but for me, I had to kind of keep remembering to just keep it very blank. No expression, no emotion.
That really kind of shows that the T-1000's a badass, and it's going to take a lot to do away with this guy.
I think that really sets a tone for the movie. That is another funny part. Right during that whole scene, when he takes care of Arnold, he looks over at the chrome dummy. It's foreshadowing, because then you're going to see the full exposure of the T-1000 for what he's really made up of.
That's Jim's co-writer, Bill Wisher, there with the camera. You see from this point how the editing and the music all start to escalate, because it's all starting to accelerate. The whole chase is starting to begin, and everything moves towards that. The camera moves, and the way that the audio and all the characters start moving forward.
The running sequences, I'm very proud of. A lot of people didn't believe that I really did do all the running. The head tilt, not only does it, I think, look good and create more of a look of menace, but it also projects constant forward motion. It looks like he's always cruising ahead.
These shots were shot in the Santa Monica Mall, and then this shot in the exteriors were shot about 5 months earlier at a mall in the valley. Stunt coordinator Joel Kramer.
Did you see 40 or 50 cars in a car chase? Chances are that car chase took 3 or 4 weeks to shoot. We'll have 10 cars here, and then you'll have opposing traffic, maybe behind a barrier like on a freeway. Then I'll have special ability atmosphere that just drive precision driving, where they're not actually involved in the stunt itself. When there's cars involved in the stunt, and people on the street involved where the stunts are happening, it's always stunt people.
They towed me on the back of the camera truck, and I just pretend like I was riding around as somebody really was like making my bike turn in different directions. It was kind of fun.
This was all shot on the streets up in the valley with Eddie on the tow rig, and the wider shots were with his stunt doubles, where we get the close-ups on Eddie on the rig, and then we just use the wider shots with the stunt doubles doing some of the gags. We kind of take a breather in the canal chase for a moment there, just so we can pause and then start everything off again. This is the corner of Plummer and Havenhurst. The truck jump into the canal was actually the first gag we did on the first weekend of shooting. It was all done full scale, so there's no miniatures or anything like that. Joel Kramer.
The other concern was the motorcycle tow truck chase in the flood control canals. We scouted the locations. We had a lot of algae. What we had to do was sandbag off miles of flood control canals and get in there with street sweepers and high-pressure steam cleaners. Just as soon as we'd clean one section, we'd shoot there, it would start growing algae, and we'd move on to the next. So we constantly had a pre-rigging team that was cleaning canals, and that was dangerous because you have no traction control at all on it, especially on a motorcycle. The man in the tow truck, he can bounce off the walls and be okay, but when you've got 40,000 pounds of equipment chasing a 200-pound motorcycle and a double that weighs maybe 90 pounds, there's no place for him to go. It's in such an enclosed, claustrophobic environment, which is what Jim wanted.
When Jim talked about the sound from the beginning, he would always talk about sounds that seem organic and real, but they're bigger than anything you've heard before. Arnold's shotgun is actually a cannon, or two cannons mixed together. We had a really big rifle sound for that at first, and Jim said it's not big enough, so we ended up with a cannon, and that wasn't big enough, so we mixed two cannons together and added in a rifle and a pistol and all sorts of little bits and pieces with a bit of canyon echo to make it really big. So eventually you have 4 or 5 elements building into one sound effect, and then finally it was big enough.
When I first did the canal, I was so focused on the immenseness and the heaviness of the truck that I missed some of the kids' nervousness on the motorbike. Jim would say, I feel like the music is so into the ponderousness of the truck that we're losing the adrenaline. So I would find a way, keeping some of that weight, I would find a way then on another layer to work in some of the nervousness.
And then with the motorcycle jump into the canal, Jim actually came up with the idea of counterbalancing the motorcycle on cables. He could computer take out the cables later on. And we started testing the stunt probably 2 months before we even shot it.
Pacific Data Images did the wire removal on that shot. There's actually a lot of little optical tricks in the sequence to make it work. This shot coming up of the Terminator riding his bike around the corner there, right here, the close-up, there's dust elements added to make it match. This shot here is a process shot lifting Eddie off the bike. The abutment ahead was built completely by the art department. There was an overpass there, but there was no center divider, and that was completely created so that we could crash the tow truck into it. Jim also likes little details, so the truck doesn't exactly explode at the beginning. He has this close-up of the battery cable sparking in order to make the truck explode, so it wasn't just one of those Hollywood exploding cars. This set up one of the main computer graphic shots in the film. Steve Williams from ILM.
Jim Cameron had stated that a lot of what he believed in terms of the invincibility of the character was sort of envisioned through CC1. A guy walking out of fire is made of chrome and he's transforming. That kind of says it all right there.
We had to shoot a plate of the background of the fire and then one of Robert actually walking out. He had to get as close to the fire as he could and then walk out very slowly and deliberately.
Okay, time out. Stop the bike. Time out, come on, stop the bike!
This is the moment after the initial chase where our characters get to catch their breath and sort of cover the exposition of who they are, why they're there, and it really is the scene in which John starts realizing that all the responsibilities that he's been given by his mother that he's ignored are real, and that he realizes that she was right about the Terminator and about the future.
Really real.
I mean, oh, you're like a machine underneath, right? But sort of alive outside.
He hasn't figured out what it all means yet, but he knows that there's now a Terminator in his life, and he's heard all about the Terminators from his mother, and for it not to be what he's always expected it to be is kind of a surprise, and he's taking it pretty well considering.
Rip John. Okay.
The following scene right after this was a bridging scene between this and the next night shot, which had the two of them riding on the bike together. That scene established the T-1000 at the scene of the canal crash.
35 years from now, you reprogrammed me to be your protector here, this time.
This is deep.
I think the scene where he steals the police car resonates with making the T-1000 scary enough and brilliant enough that he decided the best way for him to conceal himself was to imitate a police officer. Whenever one of these scenes of destruction happens, the first thing that happens is the police show up. He already looks like he blends in, and it gives him access to vehicles and everything else.
This scene gives us more exposition towards, this time, not the Terminator character, but the T-1000 character and what the characters have to do. This scene was shot for real, meaning that Arnold was riding and operating the motorcycle, and it actually was a lot more complicated than it looks, because in order to keep them lit through all of this, the camera cars all had to have these huge lights mounted on them in order to follow the characters with lights.
T-1000 would definitely try to reacquire you there.
Sure?
I would.
This scene with the payphone was shot across the street from the biker bar in Lakeview Terrace, and actually about a couple buildings down from where we did the Terminator arrival at the truck stop. We have these huge lights mounted on them in order to follow the characters with lights.
T-1000 would definitely try to reacquire you there.
Sure?
I would.
This scene with the payphone was shot across the street from the biker bar in Lakeview Terrace, and actually about a couple buildings down from where we did the Terminator arrival at the truck stop.
But I gotta warn him.
Of course, we had to build a payphone there and then add a broken piece to it. You notice this knife that Janelle uses is kind of a foreshadowing. It looks exactly like the larger knife that Janelle will been used as the T-1000. There's more foreshadowing with Max the dog barking outside, more resonance to the fact that dogs are able to detect Terminators. There's a great use of subtle off-camera sound right here as Janelle spikes Todd, because you don't see anything, but you hear a great sound effect and you don't get to see what's going on until a little later. But it completely creates the sense that something's happened and works out really well. The voice mimicry is another resonance to the first film. I think Jim was trying to put all of the little characteristics of the Terminators into the film, but to use them for story purposes, in this particular case, to figure out that the T-1000 is already at the Void House.
Where are you?
Wolfie was the name of Jim's old German Shepherd. This was the first of the Stan Winston spite gags. It's a prosthetic that's coming off of Jeanette Goldstein's shoulder and going into a piece in Todd's mouth with a little piece behind that could pull out. This was a perfect blend of computer graphics and makeup effects. Everything prior to this particular shot was a prosthetic, and this was a computer graphics shot. And the full body morph from the 2D image to a 3D model back to a two-dimensional image. This scene was to try to cover a lot of questions that the audience members might have about what the T-1000 can do, and by having John ask them, it makes it all the stronger that, you know, we've thought of everything so that we can figure out what the parameters of what the T-1000 can do are.
Can form complex machines. Guns and explosives have chemicals, moving parts.
This next scene is an added scene with T-1000 in the Voight backyard.
There's an antagonism between the Terminators and dogs that's set up in the first movie. The dogs can tell the difference between Terminators and real people, and we can't. And Max the dog knows right away that the T-1000 is not a person. And the T-1000 seems to uphold his side of that antagonism as well by just sort of killing him because he's a potential mild threat. And all he wants is a simple piece of information, confirmation that he has in fact been tricked.
There was a scene that was actually my first day of shooting that I really wish would show up somewhere, because I thought it was so cool and I thought it really kind of presented a little bit more of the T-1000 character.
The T-1000 searching John's room is a classic case of underestimating the audience, because I wasn't sure that people would get the idea that what he touched, what he had physical contact with, he could sample in some you know, fantastic way, molecularly, and he could understand the properties of that piece of matter and duplicate it. But he had to touch it.
In the script, they had him coming in and sort of ripping apart John's room. I had this whole theory that his fingertips could do a lot of reading for him. It's sort of like reading Braille. And he's so sense-aware that he doesn't rip through and tear things up. He goes in and tries not to disturb things, but just tries to find his information.
In that scene, you see it very clearly. He touches everything in the room. He's searching for some clue, and his hand goes across the poster. And he knows the box is in there without seeing it.
He's there to find something. He's there to find out where Sarah is.
But ultimately, you see the whole film cut together and you say, I don't need that. I get it. I get it already.
These photos of Terminator in the police station from the first film were all recreated because there were no such photos in the, anywhere. So what we had to do was, in the hospital, we found another place in the hospital that looked kind of like a police corridor, and we dressed it up. We had a bunch of extras come in and lie on the ground like dead police officers, and then had Arnold walk through the gun. We shot it with a video camera and shot prints right off the screen to make it look like sort of video photographs. The mall photographs were shot in a similar manner because we hadn't gone to the mall location yet, so we kind of just set it up at the hospital and shot Arnold getting up off the ground with this piece of flooring that looked like the mall flooring that we knew we were going to be using.
Wasting our time. Let's go.
Sorry, guys. Caesar's grown more and more disconnected from reality as time goes on. I'm afraid she can't help us now. If she clears it all, can give us anything, then I'll call him.
Sure.
Douglas?
This set here is the same room that was used in the sanity review hearing early on, just that it was made nighttime.
Spent a lot of time in Nicaragua and places like that.
Here's a big character arc scene for John Connor, because here's where he really realizes that his mother was correct and that the responsibility he has is basically standing right in front of him. The scene also gives a lot of exposition about the backstory that we would have seen in the movie had we had a chance to do it quite a bit longer. The crazy ex-Green Beret that John refers to in this scene actually was a character in an earlier draft, a name of Travis Gant.
She knew. Nobody believed her. Not even me. Listen, we gotta get her out of there.
Negative. The T-1000's highest probability for success now will be to copy Sarah Connor and to wait for you to make contact with her.
Great. What happens to her?
Typically, the subject being copied is terminated.
Shit, why didn't you tell me? We gotta go right now!
Negative. Not a mission priority.
You old fuck, you're a priority to me! Hey, goddammit, what's the problem? Goddammit! Help!
This does not help our mission.
Help! Get this psycho off of me! Help! Help! Help me! Get this psycho off of me! Let me go! Where the hell did you do that?
Because you told me to.
This scene was a big scene in Jim's mind as well, because it was the main scene that Jim wanted to use to show that the Terminator is basically like a gun, and that the responsibilities of having one are very great, because they can be used for good or for bad. They are completely amoral. They don't have any sense of right nor wrong. They just do what you point them at, and, you know, they shoot what you point them at. And that was the point that Jim was trying to make in this scene, that he thinks that John thinks it's so great to have this great protector and this weapon who can do anything he says, but that power is something that he really has to take responsibility for. He has to give the Terminator a moralistic stance or an ethical point of view. Otherwise, he is just a machine that can kill or not kill, depending on what its owner says.
No! Put the gun down now! Get out of here!
Come on, cuz! Split! Come on!
Jesus, you're gonna kill that guy!
Of course, I'm a Terminator.
Listen to me very carefully, okay? You're not a Terminator anymore, alright? You got that? You just can't go around killing people!
Why?
This scene was actually very, very funny, not only because you see John flustered with questions from Terminator, but the questions that Terminator are asking are very, very straightforward, because they're not questions that we can answer very easily as a society. You know, why can't we kill people? It's not because it hurts them. Why is it? And it's that moral stance that and that sense of responsibility that Jim wants to put forward.
The T-1000 theme is really a sound, almost more than a theme. I just kept experimenting with sounds. I wanted a fluidity and a strangeness. I played it for Jim, and he said, wow, that's great. And he said, it sort of sounds like weird monks chanting. It had a mechanicalness to it, but it was so fluid, I think, to match the fact that he could undulate and change himself.
Mally Finn, casting director.
When we cast Dougie, who was this ugly prison guard, he has this horrible scene where he licks Linda's face. So I would act like I was tied to the chair, and I let these men auditioning come up and lick me in the face. And Emily was taping the auditions, and she kept saying, "How can you do that? Oh, yuck! How can you do that?" But I had a great time.
Jim wanted everybody to think that Dougie was going to kiss her, but instead of getting bogged down into that kind of aspect of it, he wanted to keep the character slimy, but keep the focus on what is more pivotal about the scene and about Sarah's position.
To me, it all focuses on the moment when she pulls a paperclip out of her mouth and undoes the locks. You know, it's the paperclip that saves the world, really, in a certain way.
Linda Hamilton learned to pick locks for this scene, so she was actually picking the lock with the paperclip in the scene. Needless to say, it's a kind of a tough thing, and so our takes ran kind of long on those particular scenes.
Robert, I always feel like his antennae are out, that he's sensing, that he's getting signals from everything in the world around him.
And he sort of just places his hands on the desk, on that countertop, and it's sort of like, yeah, is Sarah Connor here? Do I feel anything? You know, am I getting anything?
And he's come up with some interesting behaviors for the character of touching objects to sample them.
The thing that Jim told me early on was, Robert, be a sponge. You can take in everything. Just take it all in and try and put it in there and make it happen.
Now we have these parallel action scenes in which Linda's trying to get out of her cell and the T-1000 is trying to find her there, and so there's this suspense of what's going on. Is she going to make it out before he makes it in to where she is? This computer graphics shot coming up was probably one of the signature images of the show because it was just so different. Nobody had an idea of how to do it. The face coming up out of the floor and pulling the tiles along with it. These two corridors, the one he just walked down and the one you see over here, are in two completely separate areas of the hospital. We kind of artificially created this L-shaped area. These computer graphics shots were fairly complicated because ILM had to model the floor and as well as the figure rising up out of it. To show to Lewis the guards, we hired twins, Dan and Don Stanton, who had been in Gremlins 2 and a number of other films. There's a computer graphics composite of the Spike coming out with a Stan Winston puppet. There was originally going to be a moment here, instead of going straight into the storage room, he actually, the T-1000 as Lewis, actually drags the dead guard down the hall right past the nurse, who can't see because of the counter, and she just says, "What you got there, Lewis?" And he just says, "Oh, just some trash." There was also a scene here as the T-1000, as Lewis was going through the sally port, where he would have to check in his gun, because normally you're not supposed to have guns inside the hospital. And there's a special effects scene that was cut where the T-1000 pretends to put the gun in the locker, but what he actually does is hides it inside his own body. You see him push his hand inside his own stomach and leave the gun there. The theatrical release of the film, you kind of feel bad for Dougie because you saw the face lick, but you didn't see, as you do in the special edition, Dougie beating up Sarah at the beginning of the film and forcing her to take her medication. So in the film, she seems a little excessively harsh, but it goes along with her character being very, you know, Machiavellian end justifies the means. In the special edition, you have a little more justification for just why she's so vicious to Dougie the guard. It kind of works both ways, in slightly differently in each version. At one point in the story, we finally decided, you know, now that T-1000 is in the hospital, he's disguised as a guard, but we really need to get him back to be the T-1000 again. And so we kind of did this classic film cheat by panning off of him and using the sound effects and the shadows and the footsteps to morph him back off camera without having to see it. This is actually stunt coordinator Joel Kramer right here in the scene that Sarah is beating up. Sarah finally gets back at Silverman a little bit and takes care of the guard with a shot of tranquilizer. Obviously, we couldn't use any real brand names on this little bottle of blue cleaning liquid, so we had to sort of create our own, give it an instantly recognizable name so you knew exactly what it was, but it wasn't an actual company's name.
Why do we stop now?
You gotta promise me you're not gonna kill anyone, right?
Right.
Swear?
What?
Just put up your hand and say, I swear I won't kill anyone.
I swear.
This shot was the only shot I know of in the movie that was also done without Eddie, just as a shot for the trailer for the film. This scene kind of is a very dark humor, showing Terminator's very, very narrow distinction on what the difference is between killing somebody and kind of just maiming them.
He'll live.
There's actually a bit that was cut out where as they drive by the guard, John kind of turns and says, sorry.
Son of a bitch. Let's all try to remain calm.
Open it or he'll be dead before he hits the floor.
There's no way, Connor. Let him go.
Open the door.
It ain't gonna happen.
Take it easy, sir. Easy.
You'll notice the use of the handheld camera in this scene is to really keep the scene very edgy, where it's very, very documentary style.
Suck off! Get back! I'll pop him full of this shit, I swear! Don't move! Drop the shit!
Do it!
Get in the office. On the floor. Face down. Not you. Open the door. On the floor. Hold it open. Face the wall.
Get her.
Nightmare, there's actually a scene where Linda runs into Terminator in the hospital, who comes and takes her outside into the nightmare playground, but that was cut out fairly early on. So this scene here where she sees Terminator after her in the hospital was a rhyming sequence to go along with that. Joel Kramer.
Hiding arm and knee and, you know, elbow pads underneath the type of wardrobe where Linda, women in general, when they're doing stunts, don't have it as good as guys do, because a lot of times they're in skirts or they're in sleeveless outfits and they have to take the bumps and bruises, and that's where a lot of judo fall training comes into practice. We can make it look like it hurt a lot worse than it really did. You do take your share of bumps and bruises.
Makeup artist Jeff Don recalls working with this female guard.
For some reason, when I looked at this woman, I saw her with a cast on. I went to Jim, ended up, he liked the idea. We put on a cast, a real cast every day, a fiberglass cast. She did her scene with a cast, and then when she smacks Arnold, she uses the cast and smacks him in the face.
Come with me if you want to live.
This is, of course, a reference to the first film where Reese says the same thing, come with me if you want to live. Dennis Muren of ILM.
We have the image of Robert that was modeled in the computer, and we had the bars that were in the computer, and the image of Robert was stuck on to the guy, stuck onto the 3D shape of Robert, and the image of the bars was stuck onto the 3D shape of the bars, and we deformed that image as we pushed it in the computer. But what we needed to do to get the thing to look right, which, because that didn't look right, it looked interesting, but it didn't look right, is to get the lighting to change, get the stretch to look right as it tears into the screen, to get it to recoil correctly when it comes out.
Robert's, of course, using another set of shotgun shirts for the chrome bullet hits. This elevator was actually built in the middle of the corridor, so it had kind of an artificial corner. Another computer graphics shot pulling open the doors. Saucehead here was a Stan Winston puppet that was then intercut with a computer graphics shot of it actually healing back up, this shot. Stephanie Austin on the elevator set.
One of the things that we did on Terminator 2 is we carried cover sets with us, one of them being the elevator set, which ultimately we shot on and off at different occasions up to and including the very last day of our shoot, when we desperately needed cover and set it up out at Exposition Park, just in a room that we were able to find there, and we actually got the last shot of the movie there in that elevator set.
They come out of this elevator set that we built into actually a garage that's in the middle of Los Angeles that's nowhere near the hospital. The hospital didn't have an underground parking garage. This bullet hole was firing a marble at the windshield so that we get a realistic in the shot, the thing cracking. Here we can see another poor guard, sort of innocent bystander, kind of get it. These two computer graphics shots, the plates of which were shot in the steel mill where we had set up the elevator set as a cover. We weren't sure how we were going to get the shot of Robert running out of the elevator. We ended up having ILM animate their computer graphics character to perfectly match a shot of Robert running out of the elevator.
Linda's shooting at me. I wanted him to take it like liquid. And so every time he took a hit, I wanted him to be real relaxed. It goes back to that theory of the martial arts. When you take a hit, instead of standing rigid and taking a hit, you sort of let your body go with it. So it gives you more of a rubberized or liquid kind of a look. There was a fine line, I think, that we were trying to go for where it stopped him enough to absorb the hit, but then he got right back into his power and he doesn't really break stride. So that was kind of hard to do physically. And I remember Jim saying, we got to see you getting the hits and letting it slow you down a little bit, or otherwise, why would they be shooting at you?
To show Terminator driving the car precision backwards, there's actually a driver in the trunk of the car who's kind of hidden, who's peering out the back windshield and driving the car backwards. We're back in the hospital parking lot now, and Robert's using Stan's hook arms.
It really worked out great, the design of those things, which kind of went with that praying mantis kind of thing.
You're going to pull up and you're going to slam that thing there and hit that spot that was the breakaway perfectly so that the hook arm would go in. But you're not looking at that. You're looking straight ahead at John. You're just human and you're trying to do obviously a non-human kind of move. It was hard.
This scene was actually shot against the process screen, meaning that we projected images of the moving backgrounds behind the actors so that we can maintain full control over all the elements with the gunfire and so on. These shots were done with the stuntmen out on location, and Stan had to build chrome rubber hook arms for the stuntmen to wear. This little chrome hook that's left on the trunk of the car in the original script was supposed to revert to liquid metal and roll off and bounce on the road in a computer graphics shot, but we never could figure out how to make that look quite right. We tried chroming silicon breast implants and so on. Never really looked quite right.
I jokingly called him Liquid Boy, and I had been toying around with that because the liquid aspects of this character were the first things that caught my eye. How to manage creating that fluidity.
This entire scene was shot against the process screen with a rear projection of the road going by. Jim uses this process a lot because he likes to be able to do those kind of things with the actors and have it all gotten in camera. And it works very well if you sort of keep the background out of focus and you concentrate on your characters in the foreground. Because it would have been unnecessarily complicated to do a scene like this with the actors in a moving vehicle. Jim tried to make it very pointed in this scene that while John wanted to hug his mother was only looking for damage to see if he was okay. She's very cold right now and has absolutely no warmth to her character. And this is one of the things that really strikes John, that she's totally ungrateful for him having broken her out of the hospital. It shows a lot of the vulnerability that John really is looking for a loving parent that he just doesn't have right now.
I didn't need your help. I can take care of myself.
What's wrong with your eyes?
This is the first reference for Terminator understanding what crying is, which pays off later in the film. Meanwhile, there are all these grips who are bouncing the car around to make it look like they're actually riding while they're showing in front of this projection screen. In the original script, there was a scene here where you see Silberman being taken away in a straitjacket because now he's seen the Terminators and believes in them and understands that we're all going to die. But we never got around to filming that scene because I think it was a little bit of a diversion. If you look closely at the gas pumps on this gas station, they have the Benthic Petroleum logo on them from the Abyss. This gas station exterior was shot out in the Palmdale-Lancaster Desert. The interiors of the gas station would be shot several months later on a soundstage in Valencia. Jeff Don talks about the makeup for the night repairs.
This was an appliance about the shape and size of a kidney. It had about a 5-inch laceration in it. We had to put a piece of Lexan, a bulletproof-type plastic, very thin, on her skin so that when Arnold was actually sewing with a real needle, he wouldn't stick her. Arnold learned how to sew with copper wire.
Correct.
Arnold's repair scene utilized makeup as well.
Does it hurt when you get shot?
Stan made a very large back piece that fit over Arnold's entire back. It was a giant appliance, and it duplicated Arnold's back musculature.
Yes.
Took a couple of hours to do, and we would put little plates at the bottom of each one so that when she would take her actual pliers and jam them in there, it wouldn't stick on in the back. They were retractable, so that it looked like they went in even deeper.
When we took out the chip removal scene for the theatrical cut, we had to cover up its absence with a looped line from Arnold that basically said, "The more contact I have with humans, the more I learn." In the special edition, the scene actually continues using a different take. Jim Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger talk about the chip removal scene.
Can we reset the switch?
How do you compellingly show that you're literally going inside the cranial cavity of the Terminator and pulling out his brain, essentially? So we wanted to do something that would be sort of visually compelling, and the idea of doing it as a mirror shot came from trying to visually validate the puppet head, that obviously we weren't going to build something inside Arnold's head, so we knew we were going to work with a puppet head, but how to make it look real. So we set up this this mirror shot where we see Arnold apparently in the mirror. In actuality, there's no glass there at all. It's a duplicate set, and we used Linda's twin sister, Leslie.
Now open the foot cover.
Sarah's reflection in the mirror.
They had to kind of coordinate their movement slowly to go and dig the tweezer and to dig the plier and to dig the screwdriver and all those things and to work in sync. Every move was done in sync. They practiced for hours on this thing. It was a coordination and working together of the makeup artist and the special effects guy and Stan Winston. Everyone together worked on that.
Well, it was really weird, too, because you get so into the scene like it's a mirror. I looked at my double, and then all of a sudden she fainted. And it looked so weird because my other me fainted because the lights were so hot.
He's completely helpless. He's completely in their hands. The most powerful, physically powerful entity in the film is reduced to a little tiny, fragile ceramic wafer that can be shattered in a split second by a 3-pound sledgehammer. His life is quite literally in their hands, which is an interesting kind of vulnerability for that character, which we think of as being completely invulnerable. He's put himself in their hands, in John's hands, and John has taken that responsibility, and now he has to act on that responsibility. He has to defend his new friend. A lot of things are happening in that scene. It's the culmination of Sarah's relationship to the Terminators in general, in the sense that she has to overcome her prejudice and preconception. We see the first real step on the path to John being this leader in the future. I thought it was important when I was writing the script that if we're meant to believe that he could ever become that guy, we have to see him take charge. And he does in many little ways throughout the film. It's consistently applied concept. It just, that scene exists for that primary purpose, to show John taking charge, taking action. We see the reins of power slip from the mother to the son in that moment. If you look at what happens in that scene, it's basically a closed circle. It starts with them in a certain situation. They talk about the removing the chip and changing it. They go through the surgery. They sew the Terminator's head back up. Afterwards, he looks exactly the same. They've changed the chip, and the difference is only what's happening in his mental processes. So you come out of 2 or 3 minutes of film basically back where you started, which is that they're on the run again the next morning. They take a vehicle, and the story proceeds. And then there's the subtle changes in his behavior after that. I could account for his behavior changes much more simply, that the Terminators have a built-in capability to observe their enemy or their targets, in this case human beings, and absorb more and more of their behavior pattern.
That character slowly develops. He adopts certain human characteristics, and he understands why do human beings cry, why do they feel pain, why do they smile, why do they feel joy, and all those things. And so the challenge in acting is really to know at which point of the story you bring those gestures in to the acting. It's a big challenge.
The human aspects that Arnold will slowly kind of pick up as the story goes on, I think are the thing that give him the edge over the T-1000.
I think in the release version, people will just think of it as the Terminator has been learning since the moment he got here, when he showed up outside the truck stop bar, and is just sort of learning, observing, watching, and gradually becoming more human, and with John's help, learning how to speak and think more like us. In the special edition, you see the chip removal. His chip gets switched into right mode, so he's actually able to learn and process information that way.
And this scene showed John teaching Terminator how to say a lot of classic line phrases that could be stored up and used later in the film for effect, like Hasta la vista, baby, and No problemo. There actually was a point where he was going to say "chill out, dickwads" to some of the SWAT members in Cyberdyne, but we never used it. You got any cash? This little moment also shows in the writing how you
take a little moment to segue into a different topic. John says no sense of humor about his mother, and then uses that as a springboard to talk about how Terminator is humorless and needs to work on that, and that's how we lead into the smile scene.
You can lighten up a bit yourself. This severe routine is getting old, okay? I mean, you're acting like such a geek. Smile once in a while.
Smile?
Yeah, you know, smile. Watch.
So then we see him being specifically taught how to smile, which is sort of a failure, although it pays off later in the film.
The idea now was to figure out a way, from the acting point of view, of how do you make it look like you have never smiled before, you know, 20 different takes, and then Jim Cameron had the choice of taking one of the funny takes. I remember when we screened it for the first time with the smile in the movie, everyone was howling. I looked basically like a horse that was trying to smile. There are no emotions there, so it's just really going through the motion.
I mean, we were dancing on a fine line of if we go too far, we might make the Terminator kind of a clown figure. It doesn't really work. We always had to reinforce the image of him as this very stoic, invulnerable, kind of humorless character, and not make any of his humor self-conscious. There was a critical kind of slump in the middle of the film that had to be shortened. And the chip removal and the smile scene and a couple of those other little snippets are all falling to that part of the film. And it's the point that Sarah's been rescued and that John and Sarah and the Terminator are all together and they've escaped the immediate jeopardy from the T-1000 and the T-1000 doesn't know where they are. In a sense, you've outrun the immediate threat that's propelled the film up to that point. So the film is just kind of floating weightlessly, waiting to define itself. What is this movie about? Is it a chase? Is the T-1000 going to get back after them and they have to run some more, which is sort of how the first film structured out? Or what's going to happen next? Where is it going to go? And that direction is not given until Sarah has her sort of dream in the desert. And the gulf between when they escape from the mental hospital and when Sarah makes her decision to go back to the city.
That character slowly develops. He adopts certain human characteristics, and he understands why do human beings cry, why do they feel pain, why do they smile, why do they feel joy, and all those things. And so the challenge in acting is really to know at which point of the story you bring those gestures in to the acting. It's a big challenge.
The human aspects that Arnold will slowly kind of pick up as the story goes on, I think are the thing that give him the edge over the T-1000.
I think in the release version, people will just think of it as the Terminator has been learning since the moment he got here, when he showed up outside the truck stop bar, and is just sort of learning, observing, watching, and gradually becoming more human, and with John's help, learning how to speak and think more like us. In the special edition, you see the chip removal. His chip gets switched into right mode, so he's actually able to learn and process information that way.
And this scene showed John teaching Terminator how to say a lot of classic line phrases that could be stored up and used later in the film for effect, like Hasta la vista, baby, and No Problemo. There actually was a point where he was going to say "chill out, dickwads" to some of the SWAT members in Cyberdyne, but we never used it.
You got any cash?
This little moment also shows in the writing how you take a little moment to segue into a different topic. John says no sense of humor about his mother, and then uses that as a springboard to talk about how Terminator is humorless and needs to work on that, and that's how we lead into the smile scene.
You can lighten up a bit yourself. This severe routine is getting old, okay? I mean, you're acting like such a geek. Smile once in a while.
Smile?
Yeah, you know, smile. Watch.
So then we see him being specifically taught how to smile, which is sort of a failure, although it pays off later in the film.
The idea now was to figure out a way, from the acting point of view, of how do you make it look like you have never smiled before, you know, 20 different takes, and then Jim Cameron had the choice of taking one of the funny takes. I remember when we screened it for the first time with the smile in the movie, everyone was howling. I looked basically like a horse that was trying to smile. There are no emotions there, so it's just really going through the motion.
I mean, we were dancing on a fine line of, if we go too far, we might make the Terminator kind of a clown figure. It doesn't really work. We always had to reinforce the image of him as this very stoic, invulnerable, kind of humorless character, and not make any of his humor self-conscious. There was a critical kind of slump in the middle of the film that had to be shortened. And the chip removal and the smile scene and a couple of those other little snippets all here, it doesn't really work. We always had to reinforce the image of him as this very stoic, invulnerable, kind of humorless character, and not make any of his humor self-conscious. There was a critical kind of slump in the middle of the film that had to be shortened. And the chip removal and the smile scene and a couple of those other little snippets all fall into that part of the film. And it's the point that Sarah's been rescued and that John and Sarah and the Terminator are all together, and they've escaped the immediate jeopardy from the T-1000, and the T-1000 doesn't know where they are. In a sense, you've outrun the immediate threat that's propelled the film up to that point. So the film is just kind of floating weightlessly, waiting to define itself. What is this movie about? Is it a chase? Is the T-1000 going to get back after them and they have to run some more, which is sort of how the first film structured out? Or what's going to happen next? Where is it going to go? And that direction is not given until Sarah has her sort of dream in the desert. And the gulf between, is the T-1000 going to get back after them and they have to run some more, which is sort of how the first film structured out? Or what's going to happen next? Where is it going to go? And that direction is not given until Sarah has her sort of dream in the desert. And the gulf between when they escape from the mental hospital and when Sarah makes her decision to go back to the city, put herself back in harm's way to try to alter the course of history, is, in a sense, an undefined or a dead period from a narrative standpoint. When I started to see the film that way, I realized that anything in there should be the biggest target area to shorten the film.
Cyberdyne computers becoming fully unmanned. Afterwards, deploy with a perfect operational record.
Here we get the whole history of the development of Skynet and all the particulars about the dates and times when everything happens.
Human decisions are removed from strategic defense. Skynet begins to learn at a geometric rate. It becomes self-aware at 2:14 a.m. Eastern Time, August 29th. In a panic, they try to pull the plug.
Skynet fights back.
Yes. It launches its missiles against the targets in Russia.
Why attack Russia? Aren't they offensive?
Because perestroika had just been happening as we were shooting the film, Jim added a line about, aren't they our friends now, regarding the Russians.
How much do you know about Dyson?
I have detailed files.
This mention of Dyson actually led us into this next restored scene for the special edition.
Where he lives, everything.
The Dyson house was actually shot in a private residence out in Malibu overlooking the ocean.
It was nice to see Dyson in his environment. We see him as a family man, as a guy who's a little bit obsessed with his work, who sees all the good possibilities in what he's creating. He's not creating a weapon. He's not creating a something that can destroy the world in his mind. In a way, he's more of an innocent. He's the Sarah Connor of the second film, in the sense that she was an innocent who had no knowledge of the ramifications of her existence on future time. Dyson is that innocent of this film. Because Sarah knows the ramifications of what he's doing and of her own actions, and he doesn't. He's just sort of cruising along, and then fate descends on him with hobnail boots at a certain moment. He's a better drawn character because he's in a family context, but he's absolutely driven to create this thing. And it really is the technological imperative. If something can be created, it will be created, if not by him, by somebody else. And that really is the open door. At the end of the movie, when Sarah says, essentially, you know, this is going to be an ongoing battle, because if Dyson didn't create the thing, somebody else will. It'll happen sooner or later, if it is possible to do. Because we just we go toward that. We want to find those answers. We want to see what's around the corner technologically. And it's a quest for some people.
This is actually a slightly smaller version of the same processor you see in the Cyberdyne lab, so you can tell that Dyson basically takes his work home with him.
Why did we get married, Miles? Why did we have these children? You don't need us. Your heart and your mind.
This kind of set up the family dynamic and the conflict between work and family.
Spending some time
in the special edition, Dyson actually also has a daughter as well as a son. But because she only appeared in this scene and not in the later scene, and this scene was cut out, you never saw her until the special edition. The Salcedo compound was shot out in the Lancaster-Palmdale desert as well. Most of the materials in the compound here, including the helicopter, were basically rented from some of the locals.
Wait in the car.
The Salcedo compound scene is actually a much cut down version of a scene in the original script that took place at the Gant Ranch, run by Travis Gant, the ex-Green Beret that John refers to earlier in the film. That scene was a much bigger version of this, where rather than just a cluster of old vehicles, it was actually a full ranch with a hacienda and gates and guards and helicopters and so on. And there was an implied romantic relationship between Gant and Sarah, who had basically used him as a way of training John to be a mercenary and to learn all the weapons and all the things that he would need to know to become the future leader of the human resistance.
Uncle Bob?
Hey, Sarita, you're pretty famous, you know, all over the goddamn TV. Pictures of you, John, your big friend here. Cops are going nuts looking for you.
Terminator picking up the baby and studying it always gets a laugh. He's got this kind of what is it look on his face.
Hey, how about the feelings out of my fucking teeth?
Now, Enrique. You two, you're on weapons detail.
To show Terminator pulling open this heavy metal plate that's over the weapons cache, which is a real heavy metal plate, Arnold is being helped by about 10 grips off camera. The art department buried a cargo container in the ground and lined it with cinder blocks to make it look like it was a permanent bunker in order to create the set for the weapons cache. They did shoot inside this underground bunker where it was very hot and dusty out on the location.
Excellent.
In the special edition, the scene between Salceda and Sarah talking about the truck is a little longer and implies that there was some kind of mileage that these two have gone through together.
Enrique, it's dangerous for you here. You get out tonight too, okay?
Sure. Just drop by any time and totally fuck up my life, huh?
Dean, I grew up in places like this. So I just thought that's how people live. Riding around in hell.
Yeah, I think that you do have to take a certain moralistic stance. I mean, one of the decisions I made before I started the picture was that I was never going to have Eddie Furlong or you know, John Connor point a gun at anybody. You know, in the extended version, we see him cleaning guns, and he clearly knows how to do it, but I never wanted that image on the screen of a, you know, 12-year-old kid pointing a gun at somebody. That was just a decision that I made. Somehow I would have to work the plot where that never happened, no matter what the jeopardy or what the justification for it was.
Are you ever afraid?
No.
Not even of dying?
We both learn off each other. I mean, he asked me why do I cry, and I ask him questions if he ever gets scared. I think that's an important scene.
No. I have to stay functional until the mission is complete. Then it doesn't matter.
Yeah. I have to stay functional, too. I'm too important.
This was the introduction, of course, to the GE minigun, which is about the only weapon that could make a Terminator smile.
That's definitely you.
When you see Linda in this movie, she is an absolute warrior. And she trained very, very hard. She worked with an ex-Israeli commando to learn to think like a warrior, which really is the most important thing. It's not just a question of physique, it's a question of the way you move and the way you think. And this is all very important stuff for her character.
The scene under the Bronco was one of the first scenes that was shot out in the desert. You can see how young Eddie Furlong actually looks in the scene. And it was one of his first scenes. It was also a major performance scene for him.
Yeah, I guess. I'm like 45.
His voice was changing over the course of the show because he was growing up. He started out a couple inches shorter than his stand-ins and ended up several inches taller. And since his voice was changing, in post-production, we had to both loop a lot of his lines and also pitch them up and down using a harmonizer in order to get them to stay relatively consistent across the course of the film.
Mom and him are only together for one night.
The way you move and the way you think. And this is all very important stuff for her character.
Mom screws it up, of course. She'd always tell them about
the scene under the Bronco was one of the first scenes that was shot out in the desert. You can see how young Eddie Furlong actually looks in the scene, and it was one of his first scenes. It was also a major performance scene for him.
Yeah, I guess. I'm like 45.
His voice was changing over the course of the show because he was growing up. He started out a couple inches shorter than his stand-ins and ended up several inches taller. And since his voice was changing, in post-production, we had to both loop a lot of his lines and also pitch them up and down using a harmonizer in order to get them to stay relatively consistent across the course of the film.
Mom and him are only together for one night. She still loves him, I guess. I see her crying sometimes. She denies it totally, of course, like she got something stuck in her eye.
Why do you cry?
You mean people?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Composer Brad Fidel.
I'd say the key thing that I felt from the script was the importance of the desert sequence. I thought that it defined to me one of the reasons for the film's existence, which was to have the world seen through the eyes of this kid that's going through all this stuff. I think when you're using music to express emotion, one of the things is the old standby, less is more. If the music's too busy or the audience feels you're telling them with the music what to feel, it's a big mistake. The music can sort of come in on a film if it's transparent enough to let the real emotion come through and just to tell the audience, you know, open your mind, open your heart, pay attention, go into these characters, look what's happening. If the music crosses that line, the audience will actually retreat from what's happening because they feel over manipulated. Jim is very interesting that way because he's very concerned about the overuse of melody. And melody is one of the composer's main tools, but he'll constantly say, I don't want to hear the recognizable theme. The use of melody in film and the use of themes and what we call motifs is really goes back to classical music. Even in Terminator, even in a movie that's even more electronic than that, you know, a good score is using theme and variation, and you may not even realize it. Sometimes the theme will be upside down and backwards, but your heartstrings still get pulled because the tonality, the notes are still there somewhere. Even if you don't understand the organization, and it's the last thing you should be thinking about. At that point, you're watching the scene. But somewhere in the color of it all, it's pulling you along. It's being there, you know, it's helping you be there with the characters.
You know, the other thing I believe strongly in is dynamic range. If everything is loud, eventually nothing is loud. So you really have to create those moments of quiet so that the loud stuff can have some impact without just becoming sort of numbing, ear-ringing stuff by the end of the film. Perfect example is the nuclear blast, which builds to a peak and then drops to zero, to where there's just a kind of desert wind blowing. You know, and that dynamic range is emphasized in that scene, probably best in the whole film.
Jim wanted to make the second nuclear nightmare almost shot for shot the same as the first one, to reiterate the recurrence of the dream. So we had to shoot Linda in two separate costumes going through the exact same shots. Gary Rydstrom.
The lead up to the explosion itself was fun because the swings and the playground equipment gave us an excuse to do some wild stuff with metal creaks. So we would choose interesting metal creaks that had a pattern, a sing-song pattern to them, and repeat this over and over again in a very haunting way. It became almost like music. For sound design, you're always looking for something in the film as an excuse to do something emotionally interesting with the sound. So that was quiet and led us into the actual explosion itself. The interesting thing about the explosion is the nuclear blast is happening far away, so the initial blast isn't the loudest part. The loudest part is when the shock wave and the heat waves hit us. So it's an inverse explosion as we would normally do it. It's a small blast that gets louder and is at its very loudest at the end of the scene and then shuts down to complete quiet in the desert.
I remember vividly how shooting this scene really affected me. It was very unsettling because of its connection to reality. This is something that could happen.
The sort of impending destruction of all civilization kind of hits her, and she realizes what she has to do. And then the film really takes a kind of a hairpin turn, turns back on itself, and she takes herself right back into jeopardy to solve a problem. So the funny thing is, the movie's not a chase from that moment on. Unlike the first film, it does a 180 and turns into something else. Sarah makes her decision to go back to the city, put herself back in harm's way to try to alter the course of history.
You said you go south with him, like your plan. Meet you tomorrow.
Mom! Mom! Wait!
In the theatrical cut of the film, the phrase "no fate but what we make for ourselves" is introduced in this scene where John says that he got it as a message from his father through Sarah. In the special edition, we hear that scene, we hear that phrase in the scene with Reese early on, so it kind of sets up a resonance with this scene, where, in a way, John is in touch with his father.
Okay. The whole thing goes. The future's not set.
And they both realize from that phrase that Sarah has decided to take matters into her own hands and try to change the future.
Yes. Oh, shit!
Dyson.
Yeah. Gotta be. Miles Dyson! She's gonna blow him away! Come on!
Sarah even looks like a Terminator here, and the music kind of reflects that coldness, that power. Again, rear projection was used in some of these smaller dialogue scenes inside the vehicles. Rear projection plates of the background were used behind the mock-up of the car. This scene was also extended in the special edition, where John goes on to elaborate a little more about the idea of why you can't kill people.
Look, maybe you don't care if you live or die, but everybody's not like that. We have feelings. We hurt. We're afraid. You gotta learn this stuff. I'm not kidding. It's important.
Also added to the special edition were these shots of Sarah stalking Dyson outside Dyson's house. These were to set up the tension for the audience who knows that Sarah is outside and she's getting geared up while Dyson inside is completely oblivious to what's going on. It's interesting to note how this scene differs, the way that the scene is cut differs from the theatrical cut, where all of a sudden we just see the dot appear on Dyson's back. They both work, but in slightly different ways. Joe Morton.
In the original Terminator, Sarah was sort of a victim in that things began to happen to her and she didn't quite know why. And it wasn't until, I guess, halfway in the middle of the movie she finds out that her son will be involved in this, in these future wars. And in some way, Miles is the same thing. Suddenly there's this woman outside his window who's trying to kill him and he doesn't know why. And then of course he's told about the future. He has no control over what is happening, and he realizes that he has to do something to change the future. So I guess in those two ways they're very simple.
We basically squibbed the heck out of this live location out in this house in Malibu. We took all the computer equipment, which were all shells, and just put explosive charges in all of them.
About the future. He has no control over what is happening, and he realizes that he has to do something to change the future. So I guess in those two ways, they're very simple.
We basically squibbed the heck out of this live location out in this house in Malibu. We took all the computer equipment, which were all shells, and just put explosive charges in all of them and blew out the windows, which we replaced from the original windows, so we could just allow this mass destruction. Notice the music that's used in this scene is Terminator's theme. It reflects perfectly the idea that Sarah has become a Terminator now, an unstoppable killing machine.
Oh!
But unlike a Terminator, Sarah has to really psych herself up in order to accomplish her mission. She's still human enough that she needs to She needs to force herself to try to hate this man in order to kill him.
Shut up! Shut up! It's all your fault! Motherfucker, it's all your fault!
Linda Hamilton.
The Terminator is edging towards a bit of humanity in this film. His switch has been reset, and hers is just shut off. In that sense, she's just a brutal, deadly, killing machine. In truth, she can't go through with that big move, and it's all to reveal how just out of touch she is with the human part. I mean, you know, it's all to demonstrate the fact that it doesn't work. You know, I mean, here she is, and she's proficient with all the weapons, and she's a great warrior. But for what? You know, he's surrounded by his family, with his children on top of him, begging him not to kill him. All of a sudden, the truth of that, and her lack of love for her son, not a lack of love, but her lack of ability to express that love, it's locked away, all hits her. And she can't do it. Nothing makes all that warring worthwhile. You don't have the love of humankind.
No shot of sound. Your heart here. Compression should stop the bleeding.
Jeff Dawn recalls shooting at the Dyson house.
The night we were shooting the skin removal on Arnold, Jim wanted a little bit more blood on the hand because it just didn't look bloody enough for pulling off. And I started to take out my blood, and I was putting blood on the hand. And one of the guys from Stan's studio ran up to me and said, No, don't do that. It'll dry and it'll gum up the mechanism. Well, this is somebody who had been working for weeks on this. This was his whole project. And it's true, the blood does dry and become very sticky, although you can wash it right out with water, but this doesn't happen for several hours. And we'd be done with the scene in another 10 minutes. And I remember looking at him, and I said, I hate to tell you this, but in another 10 minutes when this shot is over, this thing's going to be in the way. It's going to be a piece of junk to us. And Jim started laughing, and he comes over and he says, you're right. You know something? In 10 minutes, this is going to be a piece of junk, and we'll tell you to get it the hell out of our way. And this guy looked so crushed. He had spent so much time on this hand, and to be talking about it like it was a prop that would no longer be needed in 10 minutes was the climax of all the work that he'd been doing for the last few weeks. It was sad, but it's true in movie making. When you're done with something, you just have to shove it out of the way because it's now holding you back. It's in your way.
The mechanical hand was also supposed to be used in this kitchen table scene where we can still see Arnold with his metal arm, and he's flexing it as he's talking. But we decided it was just too complicated to deal with that on the location and try to get everything done on schedule. So we just had Arnold wear the black glove from this point on in the film.
How are we supposed to know?
As you can see, Sarah can't bring herself to kill Dyson, but that doesn't mean she has to like him.
How are you supposed to know? Fucking men like you built the hydrogen bomb.
Another Jim Cameron trademark is the way that he juxtaposes dramatic speeches with humor in order to take the edge off some of the dramatic speeches.
You don't know what it's like to really create.
In this scene, he has Eddie reacting the way some people might react to the drama of her speech, but the drama of the speech still comes across. But you also get a little bit of humor because you have a character reacting to it as if it's over the top.
aren't we changing things? I mean, right now, changing the way it goes.
Jim tried to shoot this scene kind of like an interrogation, so you'll notice that all the shots in the scene are sometimes these very tight, intense close-ups, and the lighting is straight down, very much as if Dyson is in a spotlight.
We have to destroy all the stuff at the lab, the files, the disk drives, everything, everything here. Everything. I don't care. The chip. Do you know about the chip?
What chip?
They keep it in a vault at Cyberdyne. It must be from the other one like you. The CPU from the first Terminator.
Son of a bitch, I knew it!
They told us not to ask where they got it.
Those lying motherfuckers.
It was scary stuff, radically advanced.
Dyson still has some enthusiasm for this technology, even though he has to temper it with his new knowledge, knowing what he knows now.
All my work was based on it. It must be destroyed.
Get us in,
past
security.
I think so, yeah. When?
This road shot was also used at the end of the film. The exterior Cyberdyne location was in Fremont, California. We found an unoccupied building in an industrial park whose owners agreed to let us basically blow up their second floor. We added a third floor facade, and we also built out the entire lobby because the entire inside of the building was empty. It was just a shell. Production designer Joe Nemec talks about the Cyberdyne sets.
We established early on that Cyberdyne was to be one of the colder sets as opposed to some of the warmer ones because we're dealing with a robot with a metal structure. That was something that we wanted to, in some way, bring into the set as well. Slick surfaces or reflective type surfaces. You're entering into kind of a machine, and machines typically are very Spartan, and they have just what they need to do the job.
Take them upstairs and show them around. Mr. Dyson, you know the rules.
These scenes were shot in the exterior Cyberdyne location up in Fremont, California, where we had built out the lobby. Now we're inside a set in Valencia, California, on a soundstage for the second floor. This was one contiguous set that connected all of the lab and security areas together. This guard is actually played by Eddie Furlong's dialogue coach, Mike Muscat.
Gibbons!
Card should access the set.
What? What is this?
Damn it. The silent alarm's been tripped.
And here we see the payoff for John Connor at the ATM earlier in the movie with his little Atari portfolio laptop computer.
We have to abort.
No.
In the original script, this scene had guards inside this little security station that they had to basically chase away.
You guys get started on the left. I can open this. I think it's that guy from the wall. Yeah, it's him and the woman. Look, just send everything you got in the area right now.
I have a personal entry code for the lab. It may still work.
Joel Kramer talks about the explosion of the door.
We built a balsa wood door, lined it with probably a four or five grain primer cord, and used a certain type of chemical to produce the flame, which is very low burning temperature, believe it or not. And then I used a certain Nomex soaked in gel, how we do fire burns, and certain gel on the stunt double space, and I gave him explicit instructions, because it was his first time actually doing it, being engulfed in flame, you know, how to handle it and when not to breathe, and it was all choreographed out.
All the halon vapor pouring into the set was a great excuse for some dramatic lighting. where we could have the light shafting through the vapor, and it kept it from being just an unmotivated kind of lighting effect. It put it within the context of the scene. Terminator, of course, doesn't need a mask.
All right, let's get to work.
This was a very dramatic entrance for the T-1000 to be seen in the film again after you haven't seen him for 40 minutes. You may wonder how, since the T-1000 is a totally simulated character, he's not actually wearing clothes, it's all simulated, where the police radio chatter is coming from, but Jim actually made a specific notation in the script saying that he's now wearing a real walkie-talkie so he can monitor what's going on. Suspect 2, white male. This whole scene inside the Cyberdyne lab was removed for time for the theatrical cut. And it shows them gathering all the data together to plant the charges and blow it up, and Terminator, of course, is taking out a few disk drives. He's got a very neo-Luddite mentality. In this scene, Dyson also gets to directly and actively face up to his research. Joe Morton.
If you just simply put down the weapons and pick up the computer chip in terms of dialing in who we're going to destroy next week, then we haven't learned anything. That the only way we learn how to deal, and this is one of those terrible cliches, but globally, is to deal with the human aspect.
Police consultant Randy Walker.
Our input as far as the dialogue was concerned was for authenticity purposes. What would the officer say when he walks up and knocks on the door, when he gets out of the car? What is the dialogue for the radio transmissions? Those type of objections. It was a lot of fun for us to do that stuff. You know, you get to stop and say, okay, let's do it again, and in real life you can't do that. You only get one shot at it.
The mobilization of the police in the parking lot required a lot of coordination and communication between the different units, including the helicopter. Production sound mixer Lee Orloff.
Chuck Tamburo was up in the helicopter. We actually mic'd him. I had a receiver on the ground, which I was able to interface with, and just took took an output off his electric condenser that he had on boom mic, and we were able to get track that way. It's an interesting thing. Does that wind up being guy track? Does that wind up being real to the point where there's an edge there that's built into that performance that you may not want to replace?
The shots of the helicopter hovering outside the second floor were also shot up in Fremont, California. We just put enough desks to suggest the second floor offices on the completely unfinished interior of the building. All these sets, where John is, are on the stages in Valencia and were shot several months later, so it's the miracle of editing that brings them together. This surveillance shot was actually shot by the documentary crew, and when Jim said, "I need a shot of police cars masking the parking lot," it turns out that Ed Marsh and Dave Hudson, our documentary filmmakers, had shot different units, including the helicopter. Production sound mixer Lee Orloff.
Chuck Tamburo was up in the helicopter. We actually mic'd him. I had a receiver on the ground, which I was able to interface with, and just took took an output off his electric condenser that he had on boom mic, and we were able to get track that way. It's an interesting thing. Does that wind up being guy track? Does that wind up being real to the point where there's an edge there that's built into that performance that you may not want to replace?
The shots of the helicopter hovering outside the second floor were also shot up in Fremont, California. We just put enough desks to suggest the second floor offices on the completely unfinished interior of the building. All these sets, where John is, are on the stages in Valencia and were shot several months later, so it's the miracle of editing that brings them together. This surveillance shot was actually shot by the documentary crew, and when Jim said, "I need a shot of police cars masking the parking lot," it turns out that Ed Marsh and Dave Hudson, our documentary filmmakers, had shot some footage of that, and we ended up taking it and using it in the movie.
How do we step them off?
Remote control.
Cheesecake. You got company.
Police?
How many? All of them, I think. Go. I'll finish here.
Gary writes from.
The minigun scene is one of my favorites. That's a sound effects editor's dream. What Jim told us to avoid were ricochets. In any gun scene in Hollywood movies, ricochets play an important part and they give it some punctuation and flair. But we couldn't use ricochets because, according to Jim, the Terminator was very accurate and knew exactly what it was hitting, and he didn't want to kill anybody, so he wouldn't hit something that would ricochet off and then kill a cop. So we couldn't have that. So we had to make the scene work with just the minigun itself and solid metal hits on cars and on dirt throughout the location. The other hard thing is that it was happening so fast. The minigun is shooting so many rounds per minute that it's hard to differentiate each of the hits or each of the gun blasts. First rule was that when you saw the minigun in the shot, you didn't hear the bullets hitting anywhere. When you saw the bullets hitting, you didn't hear the minigun. Because if you try to hear both, it would sound like too much. So we tried to really isolate. If you were down below with the policeman, you would hear the bullets hitting the car, hitting the dirt very fast, and then you'd cut back to the minigun, you'd hear just the minigun. So it was important to articulate each of these little hits.
You can see Dyson still has his reverence for the technology even here. John is just cutting to the chase and getting materials out because he knows that they are just objects.
We got Skynet by the balls now, don't we? Come on, let's book.
Police consultant Randy Walker.
He said, how would you do this for real? And we said, this is how we would do it, and showed them how to actually assault the building. We basically choreographed coming in the door and what we call running the walls. He decided that rather than have us coach the extras or actors, to just go ahead and use us because we were there. We are real SWAT officers or real policemen. And I think that he made the determination, oh, this is the real guys. And that's really how we ended up being in the film.
Time to go. Now.
Here in the lab, as the tension is building up and they're getting ready to go, we switch into slow motion. Again, to clarify the action, because otherwise it would go so fast that we wouldn't see what was going on. You see, the shots now are all in slow motion when the SWATs burst into the door and Dyson gets shot. When you shoot a scene in slow motion, you even have to loop the dialogue in slow motion. You can't use the production dialogue, otherwise it would be pitched all wrong. So in ADR, Eddie has to be saying, Mom, really slowly, but in correct pitch to match the slow motion action. And then we switch back into normal speed. Joel Kramer.
In this picture, you see a lot of people getting thrown through glass windows where it shatters into a million pieces. And that's real tempered glass. And I think the tempered glass is a much better visual effect. If you pop it with a squib, it breaks into a thousand small pieces. There's such thing as what they call candy glass, which is actually a spun chemical. It shatters easy, but it's not as visual.
There's no way out of
there. There was, of course, a breakaway wall here that Terminator bursts through. All of this was shot on the Cyberdyne stage set in Valencia Studios. One of the challenges of shooting the corridor set was that all the walls are very reflective, so so we had to be careful not to see the camera or any of the lights. These yellow barrels, flammable liquids, are marked polydichloric euthymol, which is actually a name of a chemical in the movie Outland. It's kind of an in-joke. As Dyson is dying, he's actually holding a piece of the broken neural net processor he smashed over the detonator switch. A little irony there. As the SWATs start to retreat and everybody's getting out of the building in preparation for the Cyberdyne explosion, the music is accelerating, but when we come back to Dyson, it's a very quiet, almost ocean rolling sound. Effects designer John Bruno.
Cost has a lot to do with things. The Cyberdyne explosion, we thought, well, instantly we can do that with a quarter scale miniature. On the other hand, it was the same price to do it full size.
Special effects coordinator Tommy Fisher's team set up the Cyberdyne explosion by lining the front windows of the building on the second floor with 55-gallon oil drums. Each drum contained a small amount of gasoline and an explosive charge. All these explosive charges were rigged to go off simultaneously. We had 11 cameras rolling on the shot. Since the building was near a freeway, we had to institute what was called a rolling stop with the police on the freeway so that nobody said, "Oh my God, the building blew up and got into an accident." The owners of the building were on the roof of the building next door, which they also owned, having a barbecue. Everybody in town seemed to know we were blowing up the building, and they were all behind these police barriers about a block away, about 2,000 of them. The next gag called for a walking puppet of Terminator to be hit by SWAT gunfire. Stan Winston.
We hopefully will mimic the performance of Arnold rather than Arnold having to mimic the performance of the robotic, although at times those lines do cross over.
They came pretty close to my walk, but it wasn't 100% exactly the same. So what we did then was, I then started studying the walk of the skeleton, of the metal skeleton, and what they have put together with the whole machinery and everything. And then I tried to make adjustments and walk and behave and move a little bit more like this machine. And so this way, we kind of met in the middle.
You have to use the stuff judiciously and keep referencing it with the real actor so that you never get the impression that you're looking at a puppet.
That was picture editor Mark Goldblatt. Due to the tight time schedule on the picture, there were three picture editors, Conrad Buff, Mark Goldblatt, and Richard Harris. Each of them was working on a separate series of scenes for the picture. This shot of the T-1000 riding his motorcycle actually up the stairs was shot at the hospital location because there was no stairwell like that at the Cyberdyne location. This was the first big reveal of the Stage 4 makeup that Arnold had to wear that showed his face torn up by the SWAT bullets. He would have to wear this makeup from this point on in the story, every night of the shoot. This scene was the payoff to the earlier scene in the desert where John asks Terminator about the car keys and if he's learning yet. This scene also parallels the first film in that every time Terminator says, "I'll be back," it usually means he's driving a vehicle in through the front of the building. We did two takes of the SWAT van crashing into the Cyberdyne lobby over successive nights to allow us time to rebuild the set. Because the floor was so slippery, we were afraid that the sliding van was going to crash through the walls of the set, so we sprayed adhesive on the floor of the lobby to add traction. Stunt coordinator Joel Kramer sets the scene for the upcoming motorcycle jump.
We took a Kawasaki 650, built it into a police bike that looked like a 1000. Jim needed 35 feet of lateral motion on the motorcycle to superimpose the helicopter there. I had a cable attached to the stuntman's back at 18 feet in the air, and I figured that he'd fall about 16 feet back into a box catcher that we built below the camera line. So it was a real safe gag. We tested it, did a lot of testing on it, and it came out picture perfect.
In the original script, the T-1000 simply kills the helicopter pilot. John Bruno discusses the changing of that scene.
While we're studying Terminator 1, what Arnold did as a T-800 basically sort of acquired a truck, opened the truck and told the guy to get out, which he did, which he just stepped down a few feet from the cab. Well, here it was the same situation where he should say, get out. And this would be a funnier gag.
This scene finally ended up being one of the most complex scenes editorially to cut together because it involves so many different kinds of shots shot over so many different months. The interior of the SWAT van during the chase was the cover set for the freeway location, and sure enough, it rained, so we needed to use it. We removed the left side wall of the van and shot Linda and Eddie inside it while the grips rocked the stationary vehicle, and the lighting crew panned searchlights through the back. Stephanie Austin, John Bruno, and Joel Kramer talk about the scene.
One of the most frustrating things for me was the helicopter sequence. These are quite elaborate stunts and involve mechanical effects and special effects all sort of balled up into one, and any individual cut might be a second or 2 seconds long, but each one of those took a considerable amount of time to set up and shoot.
If we could figure out a way to lift this full-size helicopter on a cable and drive that down the road.
Chuck Tamboro is the finest helicopter pilot in the business. If there was a jam up or somebody got in an accident, we always had we could talk on the radios, and Chuck knew exactly what was going to happen. There was no way we could take a chance on having that helicopter go down. You got to choreograph it out like a dance or a fight. Everybody has to be on the mark. Now, you don't have any accidents.
The helicopter flew under this overpass, and that was done for real.
A lot of people have asked me, you know, in that helicopter scene, you have four arms. I can see the stuntman's arms. And it's not true, folks, because the T-1000 has a weapon for every job. And when he was flying the helicopter, he realized that the only way that he could reload and shoot was to spread out two more arms so they could control the joystick and the cyclical.
We did an enormous amount of practical shooting on the Long Beach freeway. We basically shut down about a 2.5 mile stretch of freeway for weeks at a time at night. Traffic was rerouted, all we shot on one part.
The conclusion of this chase, the helicopter was supposed to crash into the back of the SWAT van as a miniature. That particular shot would be the only model of miniatures in the sequence. But the cost of doing that was equal to the cost of doing a whole sequence live. When you start juggling those two sums and what you get for reality, you always try to do it for real. We ended up doing it live.
We did 3 takes of the helicopter crashing on the freeway. All of these stunts were done live, including the roll over the SWAT van and it sliding along the road. Stan Winston put together a very simple but effective pop-up blade gag on the back of this truck driver to show the T-1000 spiking the guy. We never had to do anything with Robert, but just to suggest that his arm was morphing back, you'll notice it's silver in this shot.
The post-SWAT shootout makeup took 2 hours and 45 minutes to apply and about 45 minutes to take off. That's myself and Steve LaPorte applying. The first time Arnold's daughter saw him with his face torn apart, she started screaming. She was so frightened. For daddy, all ripped apart and didn't understand.
This brief interlude to change vehicles was an opportunity to catch one's breath before accelerating into the chase again. Brad Fidel.
Scoring an action sequence is an interesting challenge. It's not a big problem to score a minute of action because it's a burst of energy. But when you get into 5, 6, 7 minutes of action, which you have in the Terminator films, I like to plot the whole thing and think of an emotional story behind a given action sequence. If you'll really study, you'll notice that probably no more than 45 seconds or minutes goes by without a shift in the rhythm. In music, any good trick can be overused, but modulation, which means taking the pitch up, moving the tone up higher and higher, gives you that feeling you're approaching something that is going to have a climax.
Picture editor Mark Goldblatt.
The first version I cut actually was quite a bit longer. I have a tendency on action things to sometimes milk things to the point of an extreme, I mean, too much. So in fact, but you can always cut it down. So instead of the T-1000 in the big tanker truck hitting Terminator and Sarah and John in their little truck, you know, once, I have them hit it 5 times. Boom, boom, boom. So the scene was much longer and much more redundant in a way. And Jim's feeling was twofold. First of all, he felt that trying to make a big, a huge moment out of that whole scene kind of diminished itself because we had an earlier chase, a canal chase, in the picture, which was a very big chase scene. And in some ways, this scene could tend to parallel that if it was given the same importance. So we decided, and it was really Jim's feeling, you know, instead of hitting it five times, hit it, you know, one time and get on to the next beat. And it worked very well. And it really shaved a lot of time off that scene.
This whole sequence was a complex series of stunts shot on the freeway. These shots were intercut with footage of the principal actors on a process stage, where the backgrounds were projected behind them on a rear projection screen. Gary Reitstrom added some lion roars to the sound of the tanker to add a subliminal sense of menace. Joel Kramer discusses the shots of Arnold's stunt double Peter Kent crossing over to the hood of the tanker.
What we did is Jeff Dasnell actually drove the truck doubling the T-1000, and we were doing about 35 miles an hour. And Peter had to climb out. We had another double inside the truck that took over.
Peter was shooting blanks into the windshield at close range. There was both a piece of shattering glass and a piece of Lexan to protect the stunt driver. The action of the tanker rolling over and sliding on its side were a combination of full-scale live-action stunts and miniatures shot by Gene Warren of Fantasy II. There were also a number of rear projection shots using plates shot out on location and miniature plates shot by Fantasy II. The shots of the tanker crashing into the steel mill, breaking in half, and spilling its liquid nitrogen were done as miniatures. Gene Warren.
To tell the story, you needed to see that it was liquid pouring across the ground. Using pure liquid nitrogen didn't work. It generates so much gas, smoke, steam, its own cloud, that it's what it looks like, the smoke pouring out, and you cannot see any liquid at all. However, it was nitrogen, so it's got a billow and steam, and so we ended up having a mixture of liquid nitrogen and alcohol.
A full-scale split-open tanker was then dressed in its final position at the actual steel mill location, with vapor pouring out of it to get the shots of the T-1000 first climbing out of the cab. The freezing shots showing the T-1000 actually breaking apart were filmed on a soundstage much later to ensure better control over the special effects. Gary Reitstrom.
I also like the moment when the T-1000 is frozen. It was fun to do from a sound standpoint because it's different. The frozen T-1000 steps were just walking on a frozen lake, and the ice would crack and squeak and creak underneath your weight.
The shattering of the T-1000 was accomplished by Stan Winston's studio using a number of prosthetic appliances attached to an amputee, as well as having Robert Patrick with his feet through holes in the floor. Bits of iridescent Christmas garland were sprayed all over Robert Patrick to give the impression that frost had covered the T-1000's body.
And then when the T-1000's broken into a thousand pieces, we just dropped some nails on the floor and had this musical metal ringing out that worked perfectly with the picture.
The shattering T-1000 was a hollow puppet built by Stan Winston that was filled with chrome shards and glitter and was detonated by Tommy Fisher's crew. Stephanie Austin.
The steel mill was real tricky. And once we actually got out there and started looking at it, it had these wonderful pouring melting pots, and it seemed to have all the elements. There was a moment of real panic just a few weeks before we started shooting. We get this phone call: no, you can't shoot in the steel mill because we're selling it to the Chinese and it's going to be disassembled and moved to mainland China. Everybody was coming unglued. This was our principal location and one that we knew was not easily going to be replaced. We started contacting every steel mill in the United States. We called people, we got tapes, we sent people everywhere trying to find a backup. And meantime, trying to talk to the owners of the steel mill. As it turned out, we were able to strike a deal with them that allowed us to shoot there with a proviso in the lease that if the sale should go through during the time that we were there, the Chinese would agree to allow us to complete filming.
The reformation of the T-1000 was a combination of traditional miniature shots of mercury flowing together, shot by Forward Productions, and computer graphics shots done by Industrial Light and Magic. The ILM shots were particularly complex because the chrome T-1000 had to reflect not only the steel mill environment, but also the moving sparks. The digital animators also had to match the move of the T-1000 in the computer to the camera move. The scene shows the seeming unstoppability of the Terminators and their ability to bounce back from any adversity. Jim Cameron.
The thing about the Terminators is that nothing daunts them. And part of the fun of it is seeing how in the first film you could run the guy over with a truck and set him on fire and burn him down to his hydraulic endoskeleton and he's still on your case. And then you can blow him up and cut him in half and the arms and the upper body will still be on your case. A little bit of that unstoppable determination in the face of, you know, the glitching, the whatever it was, power failure, the inability to control his molecular substance, and it doesn't bother him. He doesn't like sort of stop and get freaked out by it. It's just to give the audience enough hope that these characters, if they just kept running, if they just kept ahead of it, they might be able to get away. The shots of the glitching themselves are quite interesting visually. They're a little confusing, but they're interesting.
I thought that stuff was cool because that means if he can't control what's happening to him, then he's starting to lose it.
Mark DePay of ILM.
So it was a really interesting interaction with his foot and diamond plate. It sounds like a simple thing in concept, but to achieve that in animation-wise was one heck of a ride. It definitely took a lot of effort.
Molten steel is something that is very hard to duplicate visually. It's literally liquid light. Steel is, you know, 2200 degrees Fahrenheit. It emits an orange-white light from its physical substance. So we were really doing back handsprings to try to make that work. It doesn't sound like the most difficult thing to do in the movie because when you look at it, it's very hard to duplicate visually. It's literally liquid light. Steel is, you know, 2200 degrees Fahrenheit. It emits an orange-white light from its physical substance. So we were really doing back handsprings to try to make that work. It doesn't sound like the most difficult thing to do in the movie because when you look at it, you go, oh, they went to a steel mill. Right, how do you shoot in a working steel mill? You can't do that.
The visual illusion was enhanced by the sound effects.
All the molten metal pits are just, the roar of them is actually a furnace here in the tech building at the ranch, recorded up close.
Joel Kramer.
Talking about the safety of the fight sequence in the steel mill, that was tough because we had so many sharp objects. It was all metal in a real steel mill. Jim and I went in there with a couple of doubles and we blocked out the whole fight. And then we took thick, dense rubber and glued it on every spot where there could be possible injury in close proximity to the fight and where the actors and the stuntmen were being run into heavy objects. And you can actually take quite a blow with this rubber and it looks a lot more dangerous than it feels. It's actually quite comforting.
Other less technical methods were intercut with the computer graphics.
There are one or two shots of the T-1000 that are basically a guy wrapped in aluminum foil, but they're fairly quick cuts, as you can imagine.
Mark DePay of ILM.
The glitch where you see the metallic band of polyalloy wipe up his body, that was done by actually just sort of rotoscoping our metallic body in place and just doing a sort of wipe across it, this little banded wipe.
This wide crane shot really shows the coordination between the lighting crew, the art department, and the special effects team to create the look of a working steel mill. Fantasy 2 added some animated electricity to these shots of Arnold tearing the Stan Winston prosthetic arm out of the gear. Although the steel mill set looked great, it was a major challenge for production mixer Lee Orloff.
It's a phenomenal amount of special effects that are required to turn that defunct steel mill into an active, blazing, hot inferno. Steam, the knee foggers, the sparkers. Those things they're killer in terms of the production mixer. And everywhere you turn around, you've got 90% humidity, so your microphones are being inundated with that. We're switching microphones out on, you know, a regular basis. You can just feel the water on the diaphragm getting heavier and heavier. The transients are going. Pull it out, but you get another one in. So you're basically trying to keep track of those things and at the same time make a choice as to what the best way to get the stuff is.
The following series of T-1000 gags really shows the seamless blending of Stan Winston's prosthetic and puppet effects with ILM's computer graphic shots. The puppet we called Donut Head was shot on the set and was followed by a computer graphics shot of the hole closing up. for the shots of Sarah being spiked to the wall, Robert Patrick wore chrome finger spike gloves attached to a harness on Linda Hamilton's shoulder.
Call to John. I know this hurts. Call John.
A computer graphics shot was then used to show the T-1000 extending a finger spike towards Sarah. Stan Winston and ILM's Dennis Muren discussed the mechanical cleave body effect and the computer healing shot that followed.
Arnold takes a big thing and he goes swump like this, and half of Robert Patrick's body falls over. It's not a computerized effect. Half of him is a robotic effect that he had to wear.
That was one of sort of the breakthrough shots, to be able to morph that shape over to the side and go in with paintwork and paint out the hoop that was around the body and pull that thing out. So we made 3D geometry of it, mapped the clothes onto it and extended the bar to go into it, painted out the hoop part of it, and then stretched the geometry and then added the shadow onto it.
One of the shots, actually, a shot second unit, was the smashing of the Terminator with the I-beam. The first time I shot, I was smashing one of our animatronic puppets and trying to save the puppet at the same time. We got some pretty nice shots. And I remember Jim walking over to the set after I had shot a few of them and not being quite pleased yet with how really violent it was, and showing me how violent he wanted it to be, and taking the I-beam and destroying a very expensive animatronic head. What we had to do was go and create another head specifically for the I-beam shot, where the endoskeleton within the head was really metal so it could take the thrust. It worked beautifully and Jim was very happy. Unfortunately, we crushed the I-beam with the Terminator's head, because the I-beam wasn't a real I-beam, and now we were talking about a real endo head and a phony I-beam, and the I-beam lost.
John Bruno.
Just one little sketch that I did of the 1000 spikes Arnold from behind sort of pins him to the floor. But Jim liked the idea. That turned into killing Arnold, having him come back to life.
We changed the stabbing of the Terminator to a steel grating rather than the floor so we could actually see the effect of the pole coming out the other side. This was achieved using both a puppet that we could actually stab straight through and also having Arnold lie in a skewed position on top of the grating so that the pole went right by him but looked like it went straight through his body. There was animated lightning also added by Fantasy 2. With Terminator seemingly out of commission, Sarah and John are on their own to face the T-1000 in the depths of the steel mill. For the shots of Terminator coming back online, a 3x oversized Terminator eye with the movable red lens was built. And a Termovision shot that had a lot of glitching to it was added. This was a retractable steel pole that was being pulled out so it looked like it was coming all the way through his body. This wide shot establishes the geography of the scene and the relationship of the platform to the steel molten pit that we're going to be featuring later.
John.
The Sarah in the background here is Linda Hamilton's twin sister Leslie.
Get out of the way, John.
In the special edition, we see T-1000's feet fusing to the floor, and that's how John knows that the Sarah in front of him is the T-1000. Gary Rydstrom.
We recorded a big
the T-1000. Gary Rydstrom.
We recorded a big vat of yogurt.
than a cup, and just pounding the cup into the yogurt, and that became a lot of the bullet hits on the peeling film.
Linda Hamilton has to shoot Robert Patrick very close. We're talking about 3-4 feet away. We made some special rounds that allow us to get that close, but it's still scary. I have to work really close with the director and the actor to show them these rounds are safe at that distance.
Jim threw that in as we were doing it. You know, I mean, as we were shooting that sequence, he finally said, you know, maybe you ought to just kind of... I'm glad he did that, because it does give the audience something to kind of laugh at with.
To protract the moment and make the sequence of events clearer, Jim decided to go into slow motion at this point. The pretzel man effect of the T-1000 blowing open was achieved through three different puppets, one to actually explode open, one that was just an articulated puppet to flail on the edge of the platform, and a third one to actually fall in.
I wanted the T-1000 at that point to show rage, and showing you know, like a crippled animal caught in a cage. I'm thrashing around, I'm doing the thing, and I had this plastic helmet of hair. A damn piece comes off. I grabbed the piece and put it back on. It just kept thrashing, you know. And finally I heard Jim yell, cut, and he's like, what happened in the middle of that? Did you lose your hair? He was like, yeah, the whole thing came off.
When the T-1000 is dying, that was another one where I was going to do something very...